Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. A man that I have come to admire greatly for his work in protecting the country we love over decades, experience both in the United States Army as well as an undercover operative for the Central Intelligence Agency, as a candidate for Congress, as a serious champion of free speech, notably on a platform called andmagazine.com, now available via Substack, is our first guest, one of our regulars here, I'm proud to say, Charles Sam Faddis. He's a great friend of this program and a remarkable resource on a whole host of issues that we're going to try to get as many of them from him as we can. Sam, I want in particular to thank you for a piece that you've just published entitled, "They Don't Want to Just Kill Babies. They Want to Kill the Republic." Talk a little bit about who they is in this case and the evidence that you have of that ambition that is now seemingly focused most immediately on the Supreme Court of the United States.
Well, they, I suppose, is not just the specific groups that are now threatening the Supreme Court in relation to the Roe v. Wade potentially impending decision overturning Roe v. Wade, but more broadly, this administration, the forces behind it. I mean, what we're talking about is really a Marxist revolution. We are talking about folks who do not believe in, are hostile to all of the foundational principles of this country. And we see that in regard to the use of state power, things like, you know, the new Ministry of Truth and its completely mad chairwoman. But we also see it in the use of mob violence, which we've seen all over the country in the past, and we're getting ready to see again.
Sam, there are some people, probably not so much in our audience, because we talk about this a lot, who might find this idea that it's a Marxist revolution that's underway improbable. I mean, this is the United States of America, after all, and we're not big on Marxism, or so we think. You used to contend with these kinds of characters and their agendas for a living, among other places, in some garden spots of the universe. Point to some of the evidence that that's exactly what is afoot and how we got to the point where it is not only taken hold in this country, but it is metastasizing here to the degree that you'd call it a Marxist revolution.
Well, the first thing that people need to understand, of course, is that when you're talking about Marxist revolution, you talk about communists, you're talking about folks that are very smart and very organized and very clever. Let's keep in mind that and very disciplined. And in 1917, when the Tsar was overthrown in Russia, to go all the way back to that, there was a popular democratic movement, people all across the spectrum, with the Bolsheviks as a pretty small element in between, steering a lot of things, but remaining hidden, right? Until the moment where the Tsar is gone and the strategic point in time arrives, and then we just have a good old-fashioned coup, and all these folks who thought they were going along with some glorious new democratic future discover that, no, what we have now is a totalitarian communist dictatorship. So you're going to, you know, from people in the Biden administration, you're not going to hear that kind of terminology openly. But if you look at their agenda, you can see clearly what the pillars are. And also, if you look at the mass movement in the street and actually focus on it and see the signs, the banners and so forth, even though most of the mainstream media tries not to cover it, you will, in fact, see there in broad daylight a whole litany of old school communist organizations. And if you go a couple of layers behind the curtain, you'll find those organizations behind everybody that's out there in the street. Same folks that have been trying to tear this place down for decades who are now getting their chance.
Yeah. And talk a bit about the movement in the streets, Sam. I mentioned, I think, the Supreme Court having had its, traditions as well as its security breached with the revelation of a draft opinion on Roe versus Wade. We've got, you know, now people laying siege to the Supreme Court, chain link fence being set up to protect it, and the beginning of what seems to be, by some accounts, a color revolution now emerging yet again, not unlike perhaps what we saw 2 years ago with the so-called Summer of Love. Is that what you're referring to in what's going on in the streets? And do you anticipate it's going to go in that direction, including with threats to the court or its members specifically?
Right. Well, again, these folks are very clever, right? And so there's always this appearance that's supposed to be there that anytime you see violence, it's some sort of spontaneous uprising. It's just aggrieved citizens. That is not at all what you're seeing. It's not what we've seen in the past. It is all very organized. It's extremely well-funded. Groups like Black Lives Matter got $100 million just from Ford Foundation. They are awash in money. They are very organized. And this is back to this question of challenging the Republic or wanting to destroy the Republic. The Supreme Court is threatening to issue a ruling that, in effect, as I understand it, will say the question of abortion should be decided by democratically elected legislatures. That's the sum total, really, from a legal perspective of all they're saying. The Supreme Court, a bunch of unelected justices, should not have made this decision. The right doesn't exist. Right to abortion is nowhere in the Constitution. Back to the legislature. They're not even taking a position on abortion. They're just saying the people's representatives should make this call. That is, of course, anathema to the groups we're talking about. And they are going to resort to violence. They are, and this is not just going to be marching around and a few windows are going to be broken. They're already have published the addresses of the Supreme Court justices that they think are voting for this decision and told people
the home addresses you're talking about.
Home addresses and told people to go there and enter their homes explicitly to enter their homes. They are explicitly now, as of tomorrow, as of this weekend, they are now organizing to enter Catholic churches all over the United States during worship and threaten the worshipers.
Because the Catholic Church opposes abortion.
Because the Catholic Church opposes abortion, and therefore they are going to come into the middle of your services and threaten it. Not theory. This is explicitly all over the internet. And this is just the beginning of what you're going to see.
Yeah. And mob violence is not too strong a word for it. As we saw, despite efforts on the part of the media to obscure this, 2 years ago, as I said, at that moment when Black Lives Matter was, among other things, joining forces with Antifa and shaking down foundations and corporations and others for the sorts of resources that you're saying, Sam Faddis, are now going to be available for the next phase. And the term color revolution, Sam, is one that I'd like to have you help me tease out on the other side of a very short break, because I think we need to really have our head around how this works in a democratic society like ours in particular, if violence and threats of violence are allowed to, run unchecked. In our polity, it clearly changes everything, including quite possibly the prospects for the kind of course correction that many have anticipated this fall. Elections, as we saw in 2020, I think, and you've been working tirelessly to examine this, cannot operate freely and fairly in that kind of environment. We'll talk about that and much more on the other side of a short break. Back with Sam Faddis after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute.
Nina Jegowitz has been plucked from obscurity to be the famous person she yearned in song to become. In her new role as arbiter of what is unacceptable mis- and disinformation, she is now the poster girl of an intensifying Marxist revolution in America. Tucker Carlson observed last night that Ms. Jankowicz's past antics, notably her sometimes salacious and deeply partisan renderings of popular music, her screeds, inveighing against political opponents, and yes, her own actual and absurd disinformation, obscure, like Joe Biden's affable senility, serious Stalinist tendencies. What can possibly go wrong with having such a person given free rein in a law enforcement capacity to go after political opponents, even school board criticizing moms, now officially called potential domestic terrorists, simply because she deems their exercise of First Amendment rights to be impermissible? The short answer is plenty. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we are continuing our really important weekly visit with Charles Sam Faddis, former undercover agent of the clandestine service of the Central Intelligence Agency, a man who has served his country in a number of capacities. He's an attorney by training. He was a former assistant attorney general out in Washington State, and he is these days running a terrific online resource and magazine.com. We're always delighted to be able to pick his brains, as I say. Let me ask you, Sam, to just help us grasp what is meant by the term color revolution, and is that what the Marxists are about in America at this moment?
Well, typically when we talk about color revolution, we're talking about a revolution that is built around some kind of symbology or cause that kind of galvanizes people and motivates them. So I think that is absolutely what you're looking at here. But I think, you know, you made reference earlier to the fact that in the United States, we're not really used to talking about Marxism. We are so completely sure that we are all generally on the same page. We may differ on policy, but we agree that we live in a constitutional republic. And it is very difficult for the average American to absorb and really accept the fact that what we're facing here is a deliberate, organized revolution built around whatever symbology. But the point is, these folks do not accept these bedrock principles. Free speech is an absolute for most Americans. You may not like it. You walk away. You can call me names, but I can say whatever I want. No more, according to these people. We now have huge government structures that are weaponizing intelligence and law enforcement agencies to actually come after you if you counter the party's line.
Yeah. And I want to talk to you about that in particular, in this connection with a new entity within the Department of Homeland Security, one of our most important law enforcement agencies. But before we go there, Sam, just one last question on the color revolution bit. If you look at this as a similar kind of uprising, if you will, to some that we've seen elsewhere, but not to bring about freedom as we have sometimes seen, but actually to bring down a free republic. This would cause, I think, the average American at least, to regard what's going on here as a betrayal of the country, as treason. And yet there seems to be very little evidence that at least the Democratic Party and its office holders are going to view it that way, let alone, you know, support efforts to treat it that way. Am I missing something there?
No, I think you've put your in regard to the Supreme Court thing, you put your finger precisely on the point, right? The Supreme Court, again, if it actually rules as it is expected now to rule, will say democratically elected legislatures should decide this issue. Full stop. That's the sum total legally. So these folks that are now threatening violence and, in fact, already committing violence do not believe in that principle. That's the ultimate point. They do not believe in the principle of democratic rule. Just like they don't believe in free speech, they don't believe in that. They believe it should be imposed from the top. And they are going to opt completely out of the democratic system, just like they did previously, and use mob violence to intimidate their political opponents. Now, down this road, not very far, is in fact the same road the Romans walked over 2,000 years ago when you wake up and discover that you don't vote on anything anymore. There is no republic. The mob puts a guy, or the army puts a guy in as the emperor, and all of a sudden you realize, whoa, we lost everything we had. And that's the point.
Yeah. Sam, I just have to say that one of the things that strikes me is a lot of the commentary about this decision anticipated now to come out of the Supreme Court, assuming the justices are not intimidated into changing direction or perhaps even harmed in some ways, is that the polling indicates the vast majority of people in this country support Roe v. Wade, that is to say, abortion rights. If that were so, you'd think that they would be confident that if everybody gets a chance to vote on what abortion law will be, it would come out their way. And yet, that isn't their view, and it suggests to me that maybe that's not where popular sentiment actually is. But Sam, we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about, and I did want to come back to something you've alluded to now several times. One of the people who has been entrusted with making decisions about our First Amendment freedoms within this Department of Homeland Security, one of our most important law enforcement agencies, as I said, is a very peculiar choice, I would say. A woman by the name of Nina Jankowicz, completely unaccountable, not even a Senate-confirmed individual. What do we know about this gal and her predilections and the advisability of entrusting particularly to such an individual, I mean, to anybody really, but to such an individual as this especially, the responsibility to determine what can be said and by whom?
Well, we know that she has a penchant for making very cringeworthy videos that she puts online of her doing musical performances, some of which are a little off color, more than a little off color. She seems to be mad. She is a Democratic Party functionary. She is a very radical leftist. And make a list of every conspiracy theory trotted out against the MAGA movement and Donald Trump and everybody else. And she has been 100% on board with that. And she has, of course, towed the party line on everything else. Hunter Biden's laptop is not real. It's Russian disinformation. You can predict all of this. And she is very, very clear, startlingly so, on camera all the time about the fact that she absolutely believes the government should be very proactively, very aggressively censoring what you can say and what you can do. She's a revolutionary. And in any revolution, the really dangerous people are these self-appointed intellectuals who create the basis on which you can then be dragged off to the gulag, executed, and silenced. These are, you know, you can always find the guys to do that. It's the folks who create that ideology and justify it that are dangerous. So when we're all done laughing at her Mary Poppins routine, she ought to terrify everybody.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've done a commentary today in which I describe her as the poster child, really, now, of the Marxist revolution in our country. And it's chilling, as you say. She's got, some peculiarities, but I think Tucker Carlson, you know, had his finger really on the problem in a conversation he had last night on his television program on Fox News, in which he described her as a Stalinist. And that's not the kind of person that you want anywhere near our government. I would argue, period, let alone in a position that has this potential to simply shred the First Amendment of the United States. And this is why I really commend to our audience this important piece that you've done about what the left is really gunning for. It's not just Roe versus Wade's overturning that they're up in arms about, and potentially literally so. It is, in fact, that they are seeking to fundamentally transform the United States of America, a term that Barack Obama, I think, first introduced to us all on the eve of his initial election. And it remains the abiding objective and a revolutionary one at the hands of the Marxists in our midst. We're going to talk more about all of this with Trevor Loudon on the other side of this short break. Sam Faddis, thanks for joining us. Come back to it again next week. God bless you.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He is Trevor Loudon, a friend and colleague of many years, one of the greatest resources in America today on the enemy within problem and what it means for us both domestically and in terms of our foreign policy. Trevor, it's so good to have you with us, and I want to commend you both for your body of work, notably The Enemies Within, the book and the video, and most recently, Enemies Within the Church, a really indispensable guide to what has been happening to the institution of religion in America at the hands of, well, the Marxist left. One problem that we've got, particularly at the moment on the international stage, is Ukraine. We did a very interesting webinar at the Center for Security Policy yesterday, and I commend to our audience the video, if you've missed it, at securefreedom.org. It should be up today. I want to ask you about Ukraine. Trevor, we're hearing from many on the right, and we explored this with our guests, the former Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, two prominent Ukrainian-American activists, and a man who worked for Vladimir Putin for 5 years in the Kremlin as a chief economist, Andrei Ilarionov. Talk to me about Ukraine and how you see this as an issue that is either, as some would have it, of really no importance to the United States, or something that is of very considerable importance to us as a part of the free world.
Well, I personally think it's of considerable importance. I don't think this is about Ukraine. I think this is about the whole of Europe. I think if Putin is successful in conquering Ukraine, I think the Baltic states will be soon under attack, Moldova. There'll be a direct confrontation with NATO. And that'll put the West in a very problematic position, because the West is not really prepared to fight a one-front war, especially with the current leadership in the White House, let alone what may happen if Iran joins in and North Korea invades South Korea and China attacks Pacific, and all of them are sending people across the southern border all at once. We could be in a 4 or 5-front war pretty quickly. So I think it's imperative that that Biden does the one thing that he's not really willing to do that could actually put pressure on Putin, and that is to open up the energy spigots in the United States to get gas, cheap gas back in our tanks to supply Germany and Western Europe with much needed energy, and drop the price on the world stage to the point that Putin runs out of money. And even Xi, even his Chinese help, isn't enough. I can't see anything else that's going to work here.
There are those who would argue, of course, Trevor, that it's enough for us to be sending arms to Ukraine. There are others who say, well, no, we ought to put ground troops in there, if only to provide humanitarian relief and, logistical support to the Ukrainians. Talk through your view of the advisability of those steps.
Well, this is the thing. If troops were going to go in, troops should have gone in before hostilities started to deter hostilities. Putin has crossed the Rubicon now. He can't go back. He can't retreat, because his own generals would probably depose him if he did. It would be a huge blow to the prestige of the Russian military. I don't think they would tolerate that. So really the problem is now, I think Biden is giving some support to Ukraine, enough to keep them fighting, but not enough to win. I think really Biden is using this as a way to shore up support during an election year. And you see the Democrats are all in for Ukraine, even though they've been in Russia's pocket for the last 60 years. And they're getting ready to paint American conservatives as pro-Putin traitors.
Let me ask you about the fact that the Biden team, specifically the president himself, has been in Putin's pocket, the Russians' pocket, for some time. You track these things very closely, of course. You're familiar with what has taken place with his family receiving money from the wife of the mayor of Moscow, a close Putin ally. But more broadly, there is reason to believe that what he had been doing in the not-so-distant past was really trying to compel the surrender of Ukraine to the Russians. Do you see it that way? And if so, is that emanating from this general wellspring of support for the radical left and Putin in particular?
Look, absolutely. You know, Bill Clinton, another Democrat with a Russian past, you know, forced Ukraine to give up their nuclear weapons to Russia in exchange for a very nebulous promise of American protection. But if you look at Biden, you know, they say he was a moderate. Well, during the 70s and 80s, he was one of the most left-wing members of the U.S. Senate on foreign policy, regularly going to the Soviet Union, fighting Reagan when Reagan was trying to stop communism in Latin America. And Biden owes his entire political career to an organization called the Council for a Livable World. They elected him. They guided him. That was set up by a known Soviet agent, Leo Szilard, to elect members of the U.S. Senate who had worked to demilitarize America, to cut back America's nuclear defenses and negotiate bad treaties with the Soviet Union-Russia. Biden boasted at their 50th anniversary in 2012 that they had helped, this organization helped he and Obama negotiate the START treaty with Russia that was so good for Putin and so disastrous for America that President Trump had to unilaterally cancel it. Biden has put five members of the Council for a Livable World into the State Department, the National Security Council, and into the Department of Defense, all working on U.S. disarmament, when Russia and China have never been more of a threat.
Right. And in particular on the nuclear side, and we have reason to believe that, you know, Putin may, in these circumstances, actually contemplate using his nuclear arsenal. His doctrine calls for doing so. And I think this is no time to be taking counsel from, let alone having policy driven by unilateral disarmers and pro-Putin allies in state or elsewhere. And Trevor, I guess this really gets to the heart of the matter. What you and our previous guest, Sam Faddis, have done beautifully over the years, in particular since Biden came to office, is really documenting the degree to which this administration, from the president on down, has been compromised, notably by the Chinese communists, but as you've just described, by the Russians as well. And at a moment such as this, how does that affect your expectations that we will do the sorts of things we need to do, whether it's domestic energy supply or whether it's equipping the Ukrainians to fight the Russians decisively? Or is this really just an exercise in, you know, sort of obscuring the real inclinations of this administration and perhaps leading to Putin's victory in the end with the detrimental effects that you described a moment ago?
I think the Biden administration is certainly hoping that Putin will win this. And they've worked in the interest of their enemies right through. I think if the Republicans had any sense at all, they would be mounting an impeachment on Biden right now. Don't wait for the midterms. All of this evidence of Biden's treachery, his, I would say, deliberate handing of Afghanistan to China, his green lighting to Biden to go into Ukraine, instead of putting troops in Ukraine or making a red line, Biden basically said, well, if there are limited military incursions, there'll be no U.S. military response. Well, that's as much of a green light as Putin needed, if he needed any at all. You know, Biden, for all Biden has really done to counter Putin, he might as well have defriended him from Facebook.
That would be harsh retribution indeed, would it not? And Trevor, I guess what you're getting at really is something, again, that we talked about earlier with Sam, and I know we'll be talking about with our next guest, Jonathan Edmund, and that is the extent to which we are in the hands of both a commander-in-chief and an administration under him that is really more with the Marxist revolutionaries, if not actually part of that team, than it is with the constitutional, you know, patriotic Americans and the republic that they cherish and want to preserve. And this is so frightening because at a moment such as this, as they say in the Bible, we're really finding ourselves facing emboldened enemies and an enemy within as well. And again, no one has done a better job of chronicling the latter problem particularly and helping us think through the strategic implications of it than you. Trevor Loudon, we appreciate your time so much. Come back to us soon. Obviously, this is a topic that continues to bear considerable watching. Next up, Jonathan Edmund, we'll be talking with him about this and more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Nina Jegowitz has been plucked from obscurity to be the famous person she yearned in song to become. In her new role as arbiter of what is unacceptable mis- and disinformation, she is now the poster girl of an intensifying Marxist revolution in America. Tucker Carlson observed last night that Ms. Jankowicz's past antics, notably her sometimes salacious and deeply partisan renderings of popular music, her screeds, inveighing against political opponents, and yes, her own actual and absurd disinformation, obscure, like Joe Biden's affable senility, serious Stalinist tendencies. What can possibly go wrong with having such a person given free rein in a law enforcement capacity to go after political opponents, even school board criticizing moms, now officially called potential domestic terrorists, simply because she deems their exercise of First Amendment rights to be impermissible? The short answer is plenty. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and I'm delighted to be able to welcome our next guest. His name is Jonathan Emord. He is a constitutional attorney. He is also the author of an important book, The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. It is a really important manual for understanding the fix we're in at the moment at the hands of authoritarians, both those Marxists and revolutionaries that we've been talking about with Sam Faddis and Trevor Loudon in our previous segments, and those inside the government who are at least sympathetic to them, if not deeply aligned with that radical leftist agenda. Jonathan, welcome back to Securing America. It's always good to have a chance to visit with you, sir, especially troubled times like these.
Great to be with you, Frank.
Thank you. You haven't heard my previous interviews, but I know you are as keenly concerned as are those other guests about what has been developing over the years, notably through what has been called by some of the perpetrators a long march through the institutions, a cultural Marxist march through the institutions. Remind us what the authoritarians have done in that regard and how it has brought us to the present pass.
Well, we have seen really since Felix Frankfurter began to bring his own Harvard Law students who were far left, actually Marxists themselves, into the Roosevelt administration, a steady development from the very origins of the administrative state of far left and Marxist elements. And these things, you know, Whitaker Chambers revealed these things. Our own Signal Corps discovered the extent of the involvement, even to the extent of aides to the President of the United States. I mean, we have seen a constant effort on the part of the left to take over America through the use of authoritarian means via the administrative state. And, you know, the very origin of the administrative state is an unconstitutional act. There is no constitutional basis for the creation of an institution outside of the branches of government that are prescribed by the Constitution that would be invested with legislative, executive, and judicial power. And yet that happened here in this country without an Article 5 amendment, just by a power grab. And it was done in the late 1880s. And the philosophy that drove people in this direction is actually quite remarkably a philosophy that was accepted as a basis to defend the institution of slavery against abolitionist cries for the end of it, that is in the antebellum South. And at that very time, academics in the South and government leaders, even John C. Calhoun, wedded themselves to Hegelian socialism, to Hegelian collectivism. And that viewpoint then became popular after the Civil War and continued on thereafter. And to the present, collectivism is the mantra that guides the administrative state.
Can I just ask you, because I know that this is a particular concern and has to be given the power of that administrative state, but unfortunately, it's not the only institution that was targeted by these authoritarians, Marxists, what have you. Give us a flavor of their march through the culture, through the media, through academia. And you mentioned Felix Frankfurter's law students. Another aspect of what we've just seen playing out in this Supreme Court drama is the concern many of us have that radical leftists coming out of law school are now beginning to populate in earnest positions like clerks to the Supreme Court and ultimately, of course, members of Congress and other, you know, roles in the executive as well as the legislative branches and judiciary itself. How are all of these things taken together, giving rise to an existential threat to our constitutional republic, as you see it?
So we have seen in academia, and that's a hotbed for the breeding of cultural Marxists, it is, we've seen in academia this cancel culture, this utter repudiation of all things constitutional in America, essentially an assault on American exceptionalism and greatness, attempting to describe this nation falsely as one that was born out of slavery, when in fact it was a society that was, from the time of the Declaration of Independence forward, dedicated to the advancement of individual liberty. And that achievement brought us through a civil war. But despite the reality of our history, the fantasy of the far left is a Marxist vision of a utopia in which they have control and dictate to the rest of us how we are to live our lives in a classic Marxist hell. And that is their goal. And so you see Antifa and BLM largely driven by the academia and students who are dedicated to the cause of destroying the nuclear family, of destroying religion in America, of destroying democracy, of attacking government at every level, of destroying free enterprise. So everything that describes the American epic, which is a great period of liberty and prosperity, they are against. And so they populate this administration, for example. People are completely befuddled and overwhelmed by the idiocy that they see daily coming out of the Biden administration. But that idiocy is driven by this altered state of mind, which is far left. And that is why we experience these horrific calamities with no apparent concern on their part. They don't respond to inflation like Democrats of old. They right. don't, you know, it's just not happening.
Let alone the average American. And, you know, I think it was the bard, William Shakespeare, who said there is method to their madness. And the method is, Marxism, perhaps only of the cultural kind in some cases, but it seems ever more so the actual revolutionary kind. We've got to take a short break. Jonathan Imord will be right back with more specifically about what can be done and, more to the point, what is being done by one courageous governor, Ron DeSantis, to try to stem this tide and reverse it. God love him. We'll talk about that more straight ahead. We're back, and we're continuing a conversation with Jonathan Immord that I think will hopefully not only raise even greater concerns about the condition of our nation at the moment, but I believe give some hope about its future course. You have been covering, among other things, Ron DeSantis's efforts to counter the biggest corporation in his state, a very important part of his state's economy in Florida and a powerhouse in his constituency, needless to say. Ron DeSantis, governor of the state of Florida, has taken on Disney directly over its efforts to interfere, really, with the legislative process, the lawmaking in his state, on transgender-related educational issues. Talk us through why he's completely within his rights to have taken them on, and what this tells us about the kind of state of the cultural Marxist efforts in America and doing something about it.
So Florida passed a law that would prohibit sexual orientation and sexual identity educational curricula in K through third grade. And in response to this, the Disney Corporation went ballistic, and they created this whole movement, political campaign against the bill, and really misleadingly called it the Don't Say Gay Law. The bill passed, and then the issue became one that was exacerbated by the fact that Disney announced it was going to fundamentally change all of its parks and all of its programming to include this new woke reality that children have fluid genders, they can be whatever they want, and that transsexual children are cool and so forth. And
starting at a very young age.
Yeah. And while adults may choose to do mutilate their bodies in any way they wish, when it comes to children, they're creating programming and an intent to destroy the innocence of children, to sexualize them. It would be improper to sexualize them in a heterosexual way or any other way. Sexualizing children is child abuse, and that is what they became dedicated to. Well, in response to that alteration of the environment at Disney, and the reality that the governor has, that he is really, it's instrumental as his enforcement role to protect children in the state of Florida and to protect the children coming into the state of Florida to visit, to go to Disneyland or Disney World, excuse me. So when it comes to that, they did something extraordinary, the legislature. They revoked the special privilege that has been given to Disney in the Reedy Creek Improvement District, which is a bizarre thing where private government or private company gets to be treated as a local government, essentially as a county government.
And this was done for Walt Disney, I think, as an inducement to come to Florida in the first instance decades ago.
Precisely. And it was done at that time to create a hospitable family environment that would be clean and that would be free of these very sorts of perverted influences. And
which Walt Disney was all about.
He was all about that. So yeah. It, not only has the Disney Corporation repudiated its trust with the American people, has completely eliminated the basis of their business, really, but they've also repudiated Disney himself. And what DeSantis has done by revoking the special privilege is nothing more than say, okay, we're not going to condone or be a party to creating a quasi-governmental entity and allowing you to have that status if you're going to abuse children. And in response, they've said, oh, you're attacking our First Amendment rights. Well, no, there's no specific content-based restriction imposed on Disney whatsoever. Disney can continue this foul program of denying children innocence. It's just that the state of Florida will no longer be a co-sponsor of that, by allowing them to have a special privilege.
In effect, an enabler, in a way, if that original arrangement persisted. This is not the only thing that Ron DeSantis is doing, it seems, at the in response, I should say, to this sort of cultural or other kinds of Marxist agenda, critical race theory being another manifestation of it, which he has found in large numbers of textbooks that were otherwise going to be made use of in public schools in the state of Florida. Talk a little bit about this aspect of the governor's efforts. And again, is he within his rights to be doing it? And is it in fact something that should be emulated by other political figures elsewhere across the country as well?
I very much agree that it should be emulated everywhere in the country. And what he's done is simply prevented racism from being taught in the public schools. The public schools, based on BLM critical race theory curricula and the New York Times 1619 Project curricula, have been trying to inform children of color that no matter how hard they try in life, no matter what they do, they are hopelessly going to fail because the society is, they say, systemically racist. Government is systemically racist. Business is systemically racist. No matter where you turn, you cannot succeed. That's the message that they're teaching children. And when it comes to white children, they're teaching them that no matter what they do, based on the superficial color of their skin, they are white supremacists, and they will always be white supremacists, and that they cannot escape that occurrence. So this nonsense, which is racism, which violates the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, because it's a government entity, a school that's violating the Equal Protection Clause, was the norm, or was becoming the norm, in Florida. And Governor DeSantis destroyed that. He has vigorously rooted it out of government, and that's schools, and that's exactly what he should do, and the rest of the nation as well.
Amen. We have to leave it at that. Jonathan Emard, thank you for your leadership in all these areas, your scholarship that underpins your work, the important book that has come out of it, The Authoritarians. We commend it to all of our listeners and hope that you'll come back to us soon with more to discuss about all of this. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Securing America. Come back for more tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.